Today on the show, we're going to be reviewing the book Sister Citizen: Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. The book is written by Melissa Harris Perry. Melissa, welcome to The Ink Spot with Stanley G. Robertson.
Absolutely. Thank you. And huge apology for being a bit late.
There was a monument that was proposed to be erected back in the early 1900s by a senator. He put out this legislation, wanted to resurrect or build a monument to the Black Mammy. They actually raised funds for that, and it was defeated, I guess, because of a public outcry. But do you think that that type of thing is extremely damaging? And if that type of thing is extremely damaging, why do you think that a U.S. senator might propose such legislation?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things to remember about the post-Civil War era is although the North won, although the Union won, the important thing to remember is that one of the ways in which the Confederacy won is that it won the right to tell its story on its own terms. It's why we still see Confederate flags flown, and it's certainly why we see this kind of romantic notion of the Mammy. Remember, the Mammy does not exist. She is not real. There are African-American women who serve as domestic servants, first in the context of slavery and then in freedom. But this particular idealized, stylized version of Mammy that we see in, for example, Gone with the Wind, she's a fictional character. Now think about the conversation that's just occurred around Martin Luther King and the memorial built to him on federal land there in Washington, D.C. He's one of the first individuals to whom a federal memorial has been built who was not president of the United States, right? There are those built to soldiers, but he's the first non-president and non-veteran to whom this has been built. But he was a real man. He was an actual human being who walked the earth, who was, you know, part of movements of struggle. Imagine what it means then that in the 1920s, there was an attempt to build a statue basically to a fictionalized character, and that there was an attempt on the part of the exact same Senate that refused to pass the Dyer anti-lynching bill. So the same Senate that would not for decades take action against the murder of hundreds of and ultimately of thousands of Black men, women, and children in the South. But they did find the money. They were prepared to appropriate money for the statue to a fictional character. Why? Because Mammy was so important to the mythology surrounding slavery, so important to the mythology surrounding who Black women were, that the Daughters of the American Confederacy and the U.S. government together were prepared to erect a statue in her false memory. And what I'd say is, although that was never built, largely because of Black newspapers and Black journalists and, of course, Du Bois and other African-American political leaders and to Black women themselves and their organizations, they stopped it. But they did build that monument in Aunt Jemima pancake boxes, in memorabilia that became an important part of the South and of you know, generally of American consumption. So Madison Avenue built that statue to Mammy, even though she doesn't actually exist on federal land.
In terms of this idea of the statue, is it because of shame? One of the subtitles on the book is Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. I'm assuming that's the goal of building the statue, is to create this perpetual image of shame and bring that on the Black race and in particular Black women?
I'm not even sure that those who sought to memorialize that statue even thought of themselves as shaming Black women. I think that's part of why the shame is so powerful. When you read
so you,
the letters...
So you think these people were actually sincere. They really wanted to erect
absolutely.
A monument to honor this image of the Black Mammy.
That is absolutely right. I will tell you that as I have, for example, spoken out about the help in various speeches around the country, I've over and over again had very good-hearted, very honest liberal white Americans come up to me and tell me that, no, I'm wrong because they were raised by a Black maid and this person was a member of their family and that I just don't understand. What I'll tell you is that when I read those letters from the daughter of the American Confederacy, from those senators, they do not say we're trying to shame Black women. What they're trying to say is these were the women who behaved in ways that we think of as worthy and valorous. So I think what I want to point out here is the idea that there is a kind of black woman who, in their imagination, exists as an example, emblematic of exactly how we should all behave. And it is these women who spend all of their time, their energy, their talent, their capacity, not on serving themselves or their own goals, and not on contributing to black families and communities, but instead take all of the genius that is black womanhood and put it to the service of white domestics and white families. And when that happens, these were very powerful political forces that said, this is worthy of acknowledgement. I don't think it was meant to be shaming. I think instead it was meant to be controlling, a way of saying, this is when we will respect the work that you do.
I want to go back to the notion that black women work on behalf of black men, because you talked about how black women are out there on the front lines doing what they do in relation to protecting black men. Now, don't you believe that that is as it should be? You were saying that black women in the church were more likely, for example, to support men ministers than, say, women. Now, but don't you think that that's how it should be?
No. I think, which is my short answer, which is not to say I think that black men and women ought to be adversarial to one another. Not at all. In fact, I don't think there's any possibility under an American government that has historically been so set against community interests. There's simply no way without the full participation of black men and women that we can hope to have a decent community. But that said, I think that actually the evidence shows us, if we're not careful to make sure that everyone's voices are there, then we're actually smushing, to use a technical term, an important part of our leadership cadre. But also that if we fail to recognize how all of these interests are intertwined and to say them in a very clear way, that we'll also miss just how cunning American racism can be, because it doesn't come in just a masculine version. It impacts us differently, not better or worse, but differently based on gender.
Well, what about this term, misrecognized? You mentioned that throughout the book. You said that black women have been systematically misrecognized. What does that mean?
Sure. So, you know, one of my challenges in this text was to think about, there are so many different faces and aspects of oppression that you could, you know, quite easily and rightfully write a book just about the material circumstances of inequality, what it means to have less education, less money, fewer opportunities. And I actually am not writing a book in that vein, although it would be an appropriate one to write. Instead, I'm writing about misrecognition, what it's like to constantly exist in what I call the crooked room, or in a room where all of the images about who black women are somehow skewed. They're off kilter, so that when you show up in a public place, the first perceptions that people have of you are based on a set of stereotypes that may have actually very little to do with who you are. I was hosting Lawrence O'Donnell's show, The Last Word, a week or two ago, and I made just an offhand comment about the fact that I get a lot of negative commentary about my hairstyle from people on the web. They send nasty emails or, you know, post nasty things on the web, that kind of thing. And I cannot tell you the amount of email I got in response to just this offhanded remark. But the fact is that black women, for example, when we wear our hair one way or another, are often thought to be making a political statement that we may, in fact, not be making. Now, sometimes we are making a political statement, but the very fact that something as personal and aesthetic as a hairstyle can raise such political hackles, I think, is part of the evidence of our constant misrecognition.
Yeah, you talked about that, too, in the book, and this idea that some women might advise their younger colleagues not to wear their hair in a certain way, in particular braids or dreadlocks, because they may be targeted and relegated to non-executive level positions. Do you see that as a problem?
Absolutely. And so, I mean, this is, I think, part of my point about misrecognition. There, you know, all of us in the American context are giving advice to our children, to our friends, to our peers about how to navigate the realities of American racism, right? So, you know, one of the reasons, for example, that corporal punishment, you know, beating your kids is something that happens in black communities often at higher rates than it does in white communities. One of the reasons for that is because we were protecting our children from the violence of the state. We knew that if we didn't teach our young sons, for example, how to behave relative to a policeman, that the punishment for that failure of knowing the right rules in the context of a policeman could be death. So we can sometimes come off as violent or overly aggressive as parents, when in fact what we're trying to do is protect. So similarly, if a senior colleague in a law firm tells you, honey, you cannot wear your hair in those dreadlocks, it's not meant to be oppressive. It's meant to be a way of navigating American racism. But that doesn't mean we should stop calling the judgment against our boys on the street by police officers or by lawyers against our wives and mothers and sisters and daughters in the courtroom about their hair. It still makes it racism. We may have to use whatever strategies we need to get around it, but as soon as you see somebody using those strategies, you should pause and say, wait a minute, why is that strategy necessary? Why is it important for us to behave and act and comport ourselves in ways that may not be a reflection of our authentic selves, simply in order to be able to make a living or be able to drive down the street safely? Well, and so I think that's the goal for me.
We appreciate you spending some time with us. I want you to give me a yes or no answer to this question, if that is possible. I'm going to guess that is not going to be possible to the question of whether you should wear braids in your hair in the corporate setting. Should we advise our young women to do that? Yes or no?
Oh, God, I don't know. I've never had a corporate job. I had a corporate job one summer, and I left screaming because I couldn't take these kinds of restrictions. That's how I ended up in the academy. I will tell you that even when I've gotten criticism, I wear them on air because, for me, you know, who I am inside is just it's just too important. But, you know, do I think that you should do what you have to do within the bounds of reason to feed your family and advance your career? What I can say is I will not be part of shaming any woman who makes the choices that she needs to make to feed her family and advance her career.
We have been talking with Melissa Harris Perry about her book, Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America.